It is 12 p.m. noon here on Saturday on May 26th, and this is the world we live in here on WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, streaming online at weft.org. And today I just kind of want to talk a little bit about what's kind of going on in the news in terms of state locally. A Central Illinois native who is actually a grad from SIU, if you might have heard, subdued a suspected gunman during a shooting. This is according to, I'm reading from the Chicago Tribune, so give them credit. A teacher who is a former Southern Illinois football player and a native from Mahomet, Illinois, subdued a gunman at a middle school in Noblesville, Indiana. His name is Jason Seaman. He was actually a defensive end for the Southern Illinois Salukis, and that's Southern Illinois Carbondale. And he was able to stopped a gunman from potentially harming or killing students and possibly many other teachers at this school. And again, this was in Noblesville, Indiana. And the man was injured, but I believe he was Mr. Seaman was injured, and thanks to first responders and their immediate action, he was able to get treated, and he's in recovery, I believe. So he will make a full recovery, which is good to hear. And this week, President Trump pulled out of a summit with North Korea on denuclearization in North Korea, but now President Trump told the press Friday, this is according to CNN, that he does remain he remains open on holding a summit with North Korea. I believe the planned summit is June 12th, so whether or not that will change, we'll see. I guess it looks like it could still possibly happen with on the 12th of June, but right now President Trump is saying that he hasn't totally called out that it's still possible for negotiating with Kim Jong-un, of the supreme leader of North Korea, or the leader of North Korea, however the proper term is. Today marks a kind of a special historic mark for those hopefully you are familiar with Dred Scott, who was had the infamous Dred Scott, or the famous, is known for the Dred Scott case. He was a man who was born into slavery in Virginia. This was 1800s, and he was actually owned by a man. I believe he was actually a politician. His name was Peter Blow. And is who were both Virginians, and Dred Scott, as you all probably hopefully know the history, moved to Illinois, which wasn't a slave state, or it was Illinois, I believe, in Wisconsin. But I was kind of give you a little bit of a background, and because today actually marks a historic mark. In 1830, Dred Scott moved when the Blow family who owned him, again, Peter Blow and his wife, Elizabeth Taylor Blow, who owned him, they relocated to St. Louis, Missouri, and where Elizabeth Blow eventually, the wife of Peter Blow, who eventually died, and Peter Blow eventually sold Dred Scott to Dr. John Emerson, who was an assistant surgeon in the Army Station at Jefferson Barracks. Scott became Dr. Emerson's body servant revalent. So now it's December 1st, 1833. Dred Scott traveled with Dr. Emerson to Fort Armstrong at Rock Island in Illinois. For the first time, Dred Scott was living in, this was considered free territory. For the next 3 years, he lived and attended with Dr. Emerson's needs at Fort Armstrong. And eventually, Dr. Emerson was transferred to Fort Snelling on the upper Mississippi. And this is Wisconsin territory. What was Wisconsin territory now is Minnesota. So Dred Scott traveled up the Mississippi River and even farther north. And eventually, for the next year, Dred Scott remained at Fort Snelling, who he was with his wife or bride at the time. So eventually, now we're here in the summer of 1840. Dred Scott left Fort Snelling, never to return. Dr. Emerson had been transferred to Florida to provide medical assistance to soldiers in the Seminole. So if you know the story, Dred Scott filed a lawsuit that eventually, saying that, you know, he was a free man, considering that, you know, he was in free territory, you know, like Illinois and Wisconsin. But it was eventually ruled against him that since he was an African American, that he had no rights and that he could not be considered not free, a free man. This was on May 26, 1857. So on this, you know, today marks the anniversary. I believe it's 161 years. Dred and Harriet Scott appeared in the Circuit Court of St. Louis for the last time. Taylor Blow emancipated them with papers drawn up by Arbor Nelson Crane and presented them to Judge Alexander Hamilton. You might be familiar with who that is. The judge who had originally heard the case. Afterwards, Dred and Harriet Scott were interviewed, and engravings of them appeared in the June 27th, 1857 edition of Frank Leslie's Illustrated Newspaper. And then for the next year, Dred Scott worked as a porter at Barnum's Hotel in St. Louis. So essentially with the legacy of Dred Scott, even though he did not win his freedom through the courts, he did fight and make it possible by, through the help of others and as well as abolitionists, he did. And of course, you know, this was all leading up to the American Civil War, which was, also about slavery but today marks the anniversary that Dred Scott actually eventually did get free, even though the courts ruled against him. Today also marks another anniversary of, it was 1924, the U.S. president at the time, who was Calvin Coolidge, signed immigration law which was very restrictive on immigration. And this is just a little little short video clip from the YouTube channel Coolidge's Ghost, kind of talking about where this is the words of Calvin Coolidge on where he stood on immigration.
Every race and creed that has come here in numbers has shown examples of unsurpassed loyalty and devotion to our country. But only by coming slowly, avoiding city colonies and spreading over the land, do they arrive in the real United States. We have certain standards of life that we believe are best for us. We do not ask other nations to discard theirs, but we do wish to preserve ours. We reflect on no one in wanting immigrants who will be assimilated into our ways of thinking and living.
And yeah, so sorry, I had a little trouble playing that. I had to sound off on the computer. But, and I guess I'm going to read some public service announcements here. So just. Screening daily is RBG, which is the initials for Ruth, for Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, at the age of 85, and this is a movie or documentary that is playing at the Art Theater, started Friday, May 25th, and going through May 31st. And I'll read this again. And this is RBJ. At the age of 85, U.S. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg has developed a lengthy legal legacy while becoming an unexpected pop icon, culture icon. But the unique personal journey of her rise to the nation's highest court has been largely unknown, even to some of her biggest fans, until now. RBG explores Ginsburg's life and career. Also, this week's late night movie, starting at 10 p.m. Friday and Saturday, will also be playing 7:30 p.m. on Wednesday, May 30th, is The Endless, from acclaimed filmmakers Aaron Moorhead and Justin Benson. This mind-bending thriller follows two brothers who receive a cryptic video message inspiring them to revisit the UFO death cult they escaped a decade earlier, hoping to find the closure. They're forced to reconsider the cult's beliefs when confronted with unexplainable phenomena surrounding the camp. As the members prepare for the coming of a mysterious event, the brothers race to unravel seemingly impossible truth. And also play, 15 minutes at 12:30 p.m. is All the Queen's Horses on Saturday, so that's today, May 26th, and Sunday, so tomorrow. The movie follows the story of Rita Crundwell, the now ex-city comptroller of Dixon, Illinois, who was able to steal more than $53 million dollars of public funds across two decades. In 2012, the FBI arrested Crunwell as the largest municipal fraud perpetrator in American history. And that is playing at 12:30 p.m. today, so 15 minutes, but also 12:30 p.m. tomorrow, May 27th. Uh, I am going to play a John F. Kennedy's address that he gave, which was also on May 25th. This was his address to Congress that he gave on May 25th, 1961. He talks about, this is one of his, when he starts talking about America going or putting a man on the moon. And so this is John F. Kennedy's address to Congress, and that he gave in May 25th, 1961.
Speaker, Mr. Vice President, my co-partners in government, gentlemen, ladies, the Constitution imposes upon me the obligation to, from time to time, give to the Congress information on the State of the Union. While this has traditionally been interpreted as an annual affair, this tradition has been broken in extraordinary times. These are extraordinary times, and we face an extraordinary challenge. Our strength, as well as our convictions, have imposed upon this nation the role of leader in freedom's cause. No role in history could be more difficult or more important. We stand for freedom. That is our conviction for ourselves. That is our only commitment to others. No friend, no neutral, and no adversary should think otherwise. We are not against any man, or any nation, or any system, except as it is hostile to freedom. Nor am I here to present a new military doctrine bearing any one name or aimed at any one area. I am here to promote the freedom doctrine. The great battleground for the defense and expansion of freedom today is the whole southern half of the globe, Asia, Latin America, Africa, and the Middle East, the lands of the rising people. Their revolution is the greatest in human history. They seek an end to injustice, tyranny, and exploitation. More than an end, they seek a beginning. And theirs is a revolution which we would support regardless of the Cold War and regardless of which political or economic route they should choose to freedom. For the adversaries of freedom did not create the revolution. Nor did they create the conditions which compel it. But they are seeking to ride the crest of its wave, to capture it for themselves. Yet their aggression is more often concealed than open. They have fired no missiles, and their troops are seldom seen. They send arms, agitators, aid, technicians, and propaganda to every troubled area. But where fighting is required, it is usually done by others, by guerrillas striking at night, by assassins striking alone, assassins who have taken the lives of 4,000 civil officers in the last 12 months in Vietnam alone, by subversives and saboteurs and insurrectionists who in some cases control whole areas inside of independent nations. With these formidable weapons, the adversaries of freedom plan to consolidate their territory, to exploit, to control, and finally to destroy the hopes of the world's newest nations. And they have ambition to do it before the end of this decade. It is a contest of will and purpose, as well as force and violence, a battle for minds and souls, as well as lives and territory. And in that contest, we cannot stand aside. We stand as we have always stood from our earliest beginnings for the independence and equality of all nations. This nation was born of revolution and raised in freedom
And we do not intend to leave an open road for despotism. There is no single simple policy which meets this challenge. Experience has taught us that no one nation has the power or the wisdom to solve all the problems of the world or manage its revolutionary tides, that extending our commitments does not always increase our security, that any initiative carries with it the risk of a temporary defeat, that nuclear weapons cannot prevent subversion, that no free people can be kept free without will and energy of their own, and that no two nations or situations are exactly alike. Yet there is much we can do and must do. The proposals I bring before you are numerous and varied. They arise from the host of special opportunities and dangers which have become increasingly clear in recent months. Taken together, I believe that they can mark another step forward in our effort as a people. I am here to ask the help of this Congress and the nation in approving these necessary measures. The first and basic task confronting this nation this year was to turn recession into recovery. An affirmative anti-recession program initiated with your cooperation, supported the natural forces in the private sector, and our economy is now enjoying renewed confidence and energy. The recession has been halted. Recovery is underway. But the task of abating unemployment and achieving a full use of our resources does remain a serious challenge for us all. Large-scale unemployment during a recession is bad enough, but large-scale unemployment during a period of prosperity would be intolerable. I am therefore transmitting to the Congress a new manpower development and training program to train or retrain several hundred thousand workers, particularly in those areas where we have seen chronic unemployment as a result of technological factors, in new occupational skills over a four-year period, in order to replace those skills made obsolete by automation and industrial change with the new skills which the new processes demand. It should be a satisfaction to us all that we have made great strides in restoring world confidence in the dollar, halting the outflow of gold, and improving our balance of payments. During the last 2 months, our gold stocks actually increased by $17 million, compared to a loss of $635 million during the last 2 months of 1960. We must maintain this progress, and this will require the cooperation and restraint of everyone. As recovery progresses, there will be temptations to seek unjustified price and wage increases. These we cannot afford. They will only handicap our efforts to compete abroad and to achieve full recovery here at home. Labor and management must, and I am confident that they will, pursue responsible wage and price policies in these critical times. I look to the President's Advisory Committee on Labor Management Policy to give a strong lead in this direction. Moreover, if the budget deficit, now increased by the needs of our security, is to be held within manageable proportions, it will be necessary to hold tightly to prudent fiscal standards, and I request the cooperation of the Congress in this regard, to refrain from adding funds or programs, desirable as they may be, to the budget, to end the postal deficit, as my predecessor also recommended, to increase rates, a deficit incidentally this year, which exceeds the fiscal 1962 cost of all the space and defense measures that I am submitting today. to provide full pay-as-you-go highway financing and to close those tax loopholes earlier specified. Our security and progress cannot be cheaply purchased, and their price must be found in what we all forego, as well as what we all must pay. I stress the strength of our economy because it is essential to the strength of our nation. And what is true in our case is true in the case of other countries. Their strength in the struggle for freedom depends on the strength of their economic and their social progress. We would be badly mistaken to consider their problems in military terms alone. For no amount of arms and armies can help stabilize those governments which are unable or unwilling to achieve social and economic reform and development. Military pacts cannot help nations whose social injustice and economic chaos invite insurgency and penetration and subversion. The most skillful counter-guerrilla efforts cannot succeed where the local population is too caught up in its own misery to be concerned about the advance of communism. But for those who share this view, we stand ready now, as we have in the past, to provide generously of our skills and our capital and our food to assist the peoples of the less developed nations to reach their goals in freedom, to help them before they are engulfed in crisis. This is also our great opportunity in 1961. If we grasp it, then subversion to prevent its success is exposed as an unjustifiable attempt to keep these nations from either being free or equal. But if we do not pursue it, and if they do not pursue it, the bankruptcy of unstable governments, one by one, and of unfilled hopes will surely lead to a series of totalitarian receiverships. Earlier in the year, I outlined to the Congress a new program for aiding emerging nations, and it is my intention to transmit shortly draft legislation to implement this program, to establish a new act for international development, and to add to the figures previously requested, in view of the swift pace of critical events, an additional $250 million for a presidential contingency fund to be used only upon a presidential determination in each case, with regular and complete reports to the Congress in each case, when there is a sudden and extraordinary drain upon our regular funds, which we cannot foresee, as illustrated by recent events in Southeast Asia, and it makes necessary the use of this emergency reserve. The total amount requested, now raised to $2.065 billion, is both minimal and crucial. I do not see how anyone who is concerned, as we all are, about the growing threats to freedom around the globe, and who is asking what more we can do as a people, can weaken or oppose the single most important program available for building the frontiers of freedom. All that I have said makes it clear that we are engaged in a worldwide struggle in which we bear a heavy burden to preserve and promote the ideals that we share with all mankind, or have alien ideals forced upon them. That struggle has highlighted the role of our information agency. It is essential that the funds previously requested for this effort be not only approved in full, but increased by $2,400,000 to a total of $121 million. This new request is for additional radio and television to Latin America and Southeast Asia. These tools are particularly effective and essential in the cities and villages of those great continents as a means of reaching millions of uncertain people to tell them of our interest in their fight for freedom. In Latin America, we are proposing to increase our Spanish and Portuguese broadcast to a total of 154 hours a week compared to 42 hours today, none of which is in Portuguese, the language of about one-third of the people of South America. The Soviets, Red Chinese, and satellites already broadcast into Latin America more than 134 hours a week in Spanish and Portuguese. Communist China alone does more public information broadcasting in our own hemisphere than we do. Moreover, powerful propaganda broadcasts from Havana now are heard throughout Latin America, encouraging new revolutions in several countries. Similarly, in Laos, Vietnam, Cambodia, and Thailand, we must communicate our determination and support to those upon whom our hopes for resisting the communist tide in that continent ultimately depend. Our interest is in the truth. But while we talk of sharing and building and the competition of ideas, others talk of arms and threaten war. So we have learned to keep our defenses strong and to cooperate with others in a partnership of self-defense. The events of recent weeks have caused us to look anew at these efforts. The center of freedom's defense is our network of world alliances, extending from NATO, recommended by a Democratic president and approved by a Republican Congress, to CETO, recommended by a Republican president and approved by a Democratic Congress. These alliances were constructed in the 1940s and the 1950s. It is our task and responsibility in the 1960s to strengthen them. To meet the changing conditions of power, and power relationships have changed, we have endorsed an increased emphasis on NATO's conventional strength. At the same time, we are affirming our conviction that the NATO nuclear deterrent must also be kept strong. I have made clear our intention to commit to the NATO command for this purpose the 5 Polaris submarines originally suggested by President Eisenhower, with a possibility, if needed, of more to come. Second, a major part of our partnership for self-defense is the military assistance program. The main burden of local defense against local attack, subversion, insurrection, or guerrilla warfare must of necessity rest with local forces. Where these forces have the necessary will and capacity to cope with such threats, our intervention is rarely necessary or helpful. Where the will is present and only capacity is lacking, our military assistance program can be of help. But this program, like economic assistance, needs a new emphasis. It cannot be extended without regard to the social, political, and military reforms essential to internal respect and stability. The equipment and training provided must be tailored to legitimate local needs and to our own foreign and military policies, not to our supply of military stocks or a local leader's desire for military display. And military assistance can, in addition to its military purposes, make a contribution to economic progress, as do our own Army engineers. In an earlier message, I requested $1.6 billion for military assistance, stating that this would maintain existing force levels, but that I could not foresee how much more might be required. It is now clear that this is not enough. The present crisis in Southeast Asia, on which the Vice President has made a valuable report, the rising threat of communism in Latin America, the increased arms traffic in Africa, and all the new pressures on every nation found on the map by tracing your fingers along the borders of the communist bloc in Asia and the Middle East all make clear the dimension of our needs. I therefore request the Congress to provide a total of $1.885 billion for military assistance in the coming fiscal year, an amount less than that requested a year ago, but a minimum which must be assured if we are to help those nations make secure their independence. This must be prudently and wisely spent, and that will be our common endeavor. Military and economic assistance has been a heavy burden on our citizens for a long time, and I recognize the strong pressures against it. But this battle is far from over. It is reaching a crucial stage, and I believe we should participate in it. We cannot merely state our opposition to totalitarian advance without paying the price of helping those now under the greatest pressure. In line with these developments, I have directed a further reinforcement of our own capacity to deter or resist non-nuclear aggression. In the conventional field, with one exception, I find no present need for large new levies of men. What is needed is rather a change of position to give us still further increases in flexibility. Therefore, I am directing the Secretary of Defense to undertake a reorganization and modernization of the Army's divisional structure to increase its non-nuclear firepower, to improve its tactical mobility in any environment, to ensure its flexibility to meet any direct or indirect threat, to facilitate its coordination with our major allies, and to provide more modern mechanized divisions in Europe and bring their equipment up to date, and new airborne brigades in both the Pacific and Europe. And secondly, I'm asking the Congress for an additional $100 million to begin the procurement task necessary to re-equip this new Army structure with the most modern material, new helicopters, new armored personnel carriers, and new howitzers, for example, must be obtained now. Third, I am directing the Secretary of Defense to expand rapidly and substantially, in cooperation with our allies, the orientation of existing forces for the conduct of non-nuclear war, paramilitary operations, and sub-limited or unconventional wars. In addition, our special forces and unconventional warfare units will be increased and reoriented. Throughout the service, new emphasis must be placed on the special skills and languages which are required to work with local populations. Fourth, the Army is developing plans to make possible a much more rapid deployment of a major portion of its highly trained reserve forces. When these plans are completed and the reserve is strengthened, two combat-equipped divisions, plus their supporting forces, a total of 89,000 men, could be ready in an emergency for operations with but 3 weeks' notice, two more divisions with but 5 weeks' notice, and six additional divisions and their supporting forces, making a total of 10 divisions, could be deployable with less than 8 weeks' notice. In short, these new plans will allow us to almost double the combat power of the Army in less than 2 months compared to the nearly 9 months heretofore required. Fifth, to enhance the already formidable ability of the Marine Corps to respond to limited war emergencies, I am asking the Congress for $60 million to increase the Marine Corps strength to 190,000 men. This will increase the initial impact and staying power of our three Marine divisions and three air wings, and provide a trained nucleus for further expansion, if necessary, for self-defense. Finally, to cite one other area of activities that are both legitimate and necessary as a means of self-defense in an age of hidden perils, our whole intelligence effort must be reviewed and its coordination with other elements of policy assured. The Congress and the American people are entitled to know that we will institute whatever new organization, policies, and control are necessary. One major element of the national security program, which this nation has never squarely faced up to, is civil defense. This problem arises not from present trends, but from national inaction in which most of us have participated. In the past decade, we have intermittently considered a variety of programs, but we have never adopted a consistent policy. Public considerations have been largely characterized by apathy, indifference, and skepticism, while at the same time many of the civil defense plans have been so far-reaching and unrealistic that they have not gained essential support. This administration has been looking hard at exactly what civil defense can and cannot do. It cannot be attained cheaply. It cannot give an assurance of blast protection that will be proof against surprise attack or guaranteed against obsolescence or destruction. And it cannot deter a nuclear attack. We will deter an enemy from making a nuclear attack only if our retaliatory power is so strong and so invulnerable that he knows he would be destroyed by our response. If we have that strength, civil defense is not needed to deter an attack. If we should ever lack it, civil defense would not be an adequate substitute. But this deterrent concept assumes rational calculations by rational men. And the history of this planet, and particularly the history of the 20th century, is sufficient to remind us of the possibilities of an irrational attack, a miscalculation, an accidental war, or a war of escalation in which the stakes by each side gradually increase to the point of maximum danger, which cannot be either foreseen or deterred. It is on this basis that civil defense can be readily justifiable as insurance for the civilian population in case of an enemy miscalculation. It is insurance we trust will never be needed, but insurance which we could never forgive ourselves for foregoing in the event of catastrophe. Once the validity of this concept is recognized, there is no point in delaying the initiation of a nationwide long-range program of identifying present fallout shelter capacity and providing shelter in new and existing structures. Such a program would protect millions of people against the hazards of radioactive fallout in the event of large-scale nuclear attack. Effective performance of the entire program not only requires new legislative authority and more funds, but also sound organizational arrangements. Therefore, under the authority vested in me by Reorganization Plan No. 1 of 1958, I am assigning responsibility for this program to the top civilian authority already responsible for continental defense, the Secretary of Defense. It is important that this function remain civilian in nature and leadership, and this feature will not be changed. The Office of Civil and Defense Mobilization will be reconstituted as a small staff agency to assist in the coordination of these functions. To more accurately describe its role, its title should be changed to the Office of Emergency Planning. As soon as those newly charged with their responsibilities have prepared new authorization and appropriation requests, such requests will be transmitted to the Congress for a much strengthened federal state civil defense program. Such a program will provide federal funds for identifying fallout shelter capacity in existing structures. And it will include, where appropriate, incorporation of shelter in federal buildings, new requirements for shelter in buildings constructed with federal assistance, and matching grants and other incentives for constructing shelter in state and local and private buildings. Federal appropriations for civil defense in fiscal 1962 under this program will in all likelihood be more than triple the pending budget request, and they will increase sharply in subsequent years. Financial participation will also be required from state and local governments and from private citizens. But no insurance is cost-free, and every American citizen and his community must decide for themselves whether this form of survival insurance justifies the expenditure of effort, time, and money. For myself, I am convinced that it does. I cannot end this discussion of defense and armaments without emphasizing our strongest hope, the creation of an orderly world where disarmament will be possible. Our arms do not prepare for war. They are efforts to discourage and resist the adventures of others that could end in war. That is why it is consistent with these efforts that we continue to press for properly safeguarded disarmament measures. At Geneva, in cooperation with the United Kingdom, we have put forward concrete proposals to make clear our wish to meet the Soviets halfway in an effective nuclear test ban treaty, the first significant but essential step on the road towards disarmament. Up to now, their response has not been what we hoped, but Mr. Dean returned last night to Geneva, and we intend to go the last mile in patience to secure this gain if we can. Meanwhile, we are determined to keep disarmament high on our agenda, to make an intensified effort to develop acceptable political and technical alternatives to the present arms race. To this end, I shall send to the Congress a measure to establish a strengthened and enlarged disarmament agency. Finally, if we are to win the battle that is now going on around the world between freedom and tyranny, the dramatic achievements in space which occurred in recent weeks should have made clear to us all, as did the Sputnik in 1957, the impact of this adventure on the minds of men everywhere who are attempting to make a determination of which road they should take. Since early in my term, our efforts in space have been under review. With the advice of the Vice President, who is Chairman of the National Space Council, we have examined where we are strong and where we are not, where we may succeed and where we may not. Now it is time to take longer strides, time for a great new American enterprise, time for this nation to take a clearly leading role in space achievement, which in many ways may hold the key to our future on Earth. I believe we possess all the resources and talents necessary, but the facts of the matter are that we have never made the national decisions or marshaled the national resources required for such leadership. We have never specified long-range goals on an urgent time schedule or managed our resources and our time so as to ensure their fulfillment. Recognizing the head start obtained by the Soviets with their large rocket engines, which gives them many months of lead time, and recognizing the likelihood that they will exploit this lead for some time to come in still more impressive successes, we nevertheless are required to make new efforts on our own. For while we cannot guarantee that we shall one day be first, we can guarantee that any failure to make this effort will make us last. We take an additional risk by making it in full view of the world. But as shown by the feat of astronaut Shepard, this very risk enhances our stature when we are successful. But this is not merely a race. Space is open to us now, and our eagerness to share its meaning is not governed by the efforts of others. We go into space because whatever mankind must undertake, free men must fully share. I therefore ask the Congress, above and beyond the increases I have earlier requested for space activities, to provide the funds which are needed to meet the following national goals. First, I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal, before this decade is out, of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth. No single space project in this period will be more impressive to mankind or more important for the long-range exploration of space, and none will be so difficult or expensive to accomplish. We propose to accelerate the development of the appropriate lunar spacecraft. We propose to develop alternate liquid and solid fuel boosters, much larger than any now being developed, until certain which is superior. We propose additional funds for other engine development and for unmanned exploration, explorations which are particularly important for one purpose which this nation will never overlook, the survival of the man who first makes.
11 Alive and Well is our campaign.
But in a very real sense, it will not be one man going to the moon. If we make this judgment affirmatively, it will be an entire nation, for all of us must work to put him there. Secondly, an additional $23 million, together with $7 million already available, will accelerate development of the Rover nuclear rocket. This gives promise of someday providing a means for even more exciting and ambitious exploration of space, perhaps beyond the moon, perhaps to the very end of the solar system itself. Third, an additional $50 million will make the most of our present leadership by accelerating the use of space satellites for worldwide communication. Fourth, an additional $75 million, of which $53 million is for the Weather Bureau, will help give us at the earliest possible time a satellite system for worldwide weather observation. Let it be clear, and this is a judgment which the members of the Congress must finally make, let it be clear that I am asking the Congress and the country to accept a firm commitment to a new course of action, a course which will last for many years and carry very heavy costs, $531 million in fiscal 62, and an estimated $7 to $9 billion additional over the next 5 years. If we are to go only halfway or reduce our sights in the face of difficulty, in my judgment, it would be better not to go at all. Now, this is a choice which this country must make, and I'm confident that under the leadership of the space committees of the Congress and the appropriating committees that you will consider the matter carefully. It is a most important decision that we make as a nation. But all of you have lived through the last 4 years and have seen the significance of space and the adventures in space. And no one can predict with certainty what the ultimate meaning will be of mastery of space. I believe we should go to the moon. But I think every citizen of this country, as well as the members of the Congress, should consider the matter carefully in making their judgment, to which we've given attention over many weeks and months, because it is a heavy burden, and there is no sense in agreeing or desiring that the United States take an affirmative position in outer space unless we are prepared to do the work and bear the burdens to make it successful. If we are not, we should decide today and this year. This decision demands a major national commitment of scientific and technical manpower, materiel and facilities, and the possibility of their diversion from other important activities where they're already thinly spread. It means a degree of dedication, organization, and discipline which have not always characterized our research and development efforts. It means we cannot afford undue work stoppages, inflated costs of material or talent, wasteful interagency rivalries, or a high turnover of key personnel. New objectives and new money cannot solve these problems. They could, in fact, aggravate them further unless every scientist, every engineer, every serviceman, every technician, contractor, and civil servant gives his personal pledge that this nation will move forward with the full speed of freedom in the exciting adventure of space. In conclusion, let me emphasize one point. It is not a pleasure for any president of the United States, as I'm sure it was not a pleasure for my predecessor, to come before the Congress and ask for new appropriations which place burdens on our people. I came to this conclusion with some reluctance. But in my judgment, this is a most serious time in the life of our country and in the life of freedom around the globe. And it is the obligation, I believe, of the President of the United States to at least make his recommendations to the members of the Congress so that they can reach their own conclusions with that judgment before them. You must decide yourselves as I have decided. And I am confident that whether you finally decide in the way that I have decided or not, that your judgment, as my judgment, is reached on what is in the best interests of our country. In conclusion, let me emphasize one point, that we are determined as a nation in 1961 that freedom shall survive and succeed. And whatever the peril and setbacks, we have some very large advantages. The first is the simple fact that we are on the side of liberty, and since the beginning of history, and particularly since the end of the Second World War, liberty has been winning out all over the globe.
And again, that was President John F. Kennedy's address to Congress that he gave on May 25th, 1961, and that was played on David Von Payne's JFK channel on YouTube. So thank you to that person for having that video available. And that, I just wanted to make one more little news kind of, or maybe a few more if I have time. In Georgia, Democrat Stacey Abrams won the Democratic Party nomination for the governor primary on this past Tuesday. This makes her the first black woman in the country to win a major party's nomination for governor. And she will, if she, of course, wins the governor race in Georgia, that would make her the first African-American woman to be elected governor. That race, and of course that will be in the one of many races to be watching in the November midterms. And so also in Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, the Irish Prime Minister has hailed his country's quiet revolution as there was a vote on repealing the abortion ban, and there was a resounding, the results were a resounding vote to overturn the abortion ban, according to the BBC. The people have spoken, and according to the Irish Prime Minister, they have spoken. They have said we need a modern constitution for a modern country, he said. Exit polls suggested about 69% voted to repeal part of the Constitution that effectively bans terminations. And so that's just what a lot of news happened this past week. And just kind of wanted to tell you all about it because it's kind of fascinating to watch it all, delve into it. And it seems like it's kind of hard to comprehend everything that's happened, both in our country and around the world. And that will do it with this segment, with this the world we live in, this Saturday on May 26th. I will play a song. This is from Danielle Nicole's album Cry No More, and the song is Someday You Might Change Your Mind, and it's a duet with Kelly Finnegan. So enjoy the rest of your day. Thanks. And again, you're watching. Oh, and just make it clear, the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of WFT Champaign, Prairie Air Incorporated, station management, the board of directors, or the WFT Associates. Thanks again, and this is Danielle Nicole. Enjoy the day.